8 Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll hear about the DNR's plan to nearly double the state's elk population with a helping hand from Kentucky.
First, Governor Walker's proposed budget changes for the UW system continue to get reaction from lawmakers, system faculty and administration, and from prospective students and their parents wondering how the changes could affect them.
The proposal, which would still need to go through the legislature, would cut $300 million from the UW system budget over the next 2 years. It would also change the management of the system, and the governor says the cost savings allowed by that change would help make up the shortfall from the budget cuts.
So how does this all affect students currently in college or maybe making their college plans when it comes to tuition and the quality of their education? Nicholas Hillman joins us. He's Assistant Professor of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at the UW-Madison. Nick, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So we've had callers this week already wondering, what's this going to mean for my kids' tuition and for the quality of education they get if they go to the UW system? So starting with tuition, how do you see these proposed changes as they stand now? Still some work to do on this, but how would they affect tuition?
Sure. You know, there's no crystal ball to look into to know for sure what happens or what's potentially down the pike for the state. But you can look at other states at how things have played out, and it's pretty predictable. There's sort of a series of events that unfold when states divest in public higher education. They often increase tuition rates substantially to make up for that gap. And so you see almost a trade-off here, one-to-one sometimes trade-off on replacing state support for individual student support. So basically, even though there's a tuition freeze built into the proposal right now, that freeze will thaw out, and that thaw could end up being pretty substantial for families.
Now, the case being made by the governor is, yes, there's this cut, but also there's this change in management that's going to allow more flexibility. It's going to free some things up so that the system can save money on things like construction, personnel, that sort of thing. Have other states tried to do that? How has that worked out?
Yeah, other states have tried to do something similar to this. And actually, proposals have gone pretty far down the line, and then at the last minute, states have decided they don't want to go down this route. So, again, it's hard to tell what's going to happen here, how certain of a future this all plays into. But Virginia and Colorado stand out as sort of prime examples of this type of a system. And in Colorado, it's actually some pretty interesting and scary implications that have happened there, where the four-year colleges in the state actually didn't see any efficiency gains. They sort of did business as usual, and their enrollment profiles actually changed as a result because fewer students could afford to attend those schools, and they shifted down to the two-year college. And we saw systematic patterns in who ended up shifting down to the two-year college. It was your poor and minority students. And so within the community colleges now that already have are serving a lot of students and diverse students in the first place are serving even more. And so you saw sort of a shift happen within Colorado when that kind of management change occurred. And in Virginia, we don't really know for sure how things have played out there. We can look at individual campuses like University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. They kind of followed this model where they're pretty much a free agent of the state doing their own thing and resemble a private university in a lot of ways. And in Texas, there was also a tuition deregulation that, not surprisingly, colleges cranked up their tuition rates pretty high, and it disproportionately affect poor and minority students, especially Hispanic families.
Let's dig into that a little more. How much impact does higher tuition have on the decision on whether or not to go to college at all, or maybe to switch, as you said, from a four-year to a two-year program?
Yeah, there's a lot of ways that increases in tuition affect our decisions, our students' decisions on where to enroll and how often to enroll and when to stop out from school. But by and large, I mean, there's about 30 years of research that point in this direction. A $1,000 increase in price is about a 5% decrease in enrollment demand. And so you start to price people out, and the first ones who get priced out are the people who are the poorest, unless that's made up with financial aid. I haven't seen anything in the proposal that there would be any contributions to financial aid and trying to target some extra resources to the families and students who are going to be the most hurt by the increases in tuition. But $1,000 increase, 5% decline in enrollments, and there's also sort of the marginal student who is deciding on, well, should I go to one college versus the other? They're going to sometimes go for the one that offers the best financial deal, not necessarily the best academic deal for them.
So the people with more money pay for a more expensive college. The people with less money take the more affordable options. What's the problem if that is happening more and more?
Boy, there are several problems. One, when we think about prices in higher education, prices really are not a signal of quality. Unlike in some things that we buy, you know, you can anticipate that this bottle of wine is really expensive, therefore it's probably really good. I've had some pretty good $4 bottles of wine. And it's hard to put a price on quality. And yet, there are not very many things that we can really quantify in higher education to know the quality of the experience. And so price serves as this terrible proxy, but it's one that we often use. And so, you know, there might be an assumption that, well, it's more expensive, so it must be getting better. And if that's the case, then yes, the people who have the most wealth are the ones who are going to get the those seats at those schools. So, yeah, you see a definitely pricing out of the poorest people when you have steep increases in tuition.
Well, we've been talking about tuition so far. How about quality of education? Do you, looking at what we know about this plan so far, have thoughts on what might happen, either with the quality of education directly or with services provided to students?
It's hard to tell. I think that on one level, there is some support that shows that institutional resources matter. So the support services, the academic support service or the wraparound services that colleges provide oftentimes make a important impact on the students' experience while they're in school, and it helps them persist and earn their degrees in a timely fashion. Schools that have the fewest resources are the same schools that have the longest time to degree and have the most students drop out. And so, you know, this can play out, sort of filters its way down through the university in different ways where, you know, there might be more pressure to become lean, which is code for cutting out these support services. And the implication of that would be that the students don't keep their momentum towards their degree. And so it could actually backfire in some ways.
So some of these things are things that from the outside you might look at and say, this is administrative overhead, this is bureaucracy, it's redundant. But you're saying at least some of that helps students get out of school faster and presumably with less debt when they come out.
And less debt. And that's the other part to this. So it's not just enrollment decisions, but it's also, you know, how are you going to pay for that? Some students are really committed to staying even if they don't have the financial means. So the only way they can pay is through taking out more loans. And so as tuition rises and there's not a disproportionate or equal decrease in tuition through financial aid programs, then you're going to inevitably see higher debt burdens for students.
We had a caller earlier this week who said my kid was accepted at UW-Madison at University of Minnesota. With this uncertainty, he was wondering, should he be leaning toward Minnesota? I mean, is it too soon to start for parents to start thinking about that kind of thing if these changes are in the works?
Well, it depends on if that student's going to be in the 2015 through 17 tuition-free phase. If so, then it might be a safe bet to stay in Wisconsin.
Not the freeze, the tuition freeze. Yeah.
But once that freezes over after 2017, that whole cohort of future college students are going to want to really, you know, be aware of how that might impact their decisions.
So I want to put these proposed cuts in a national perspective and historical perspective. You, in a blog post, said these are big cuts by the standards of UW history, but how do they stack up nationally in terms of cuts to higher education by states?
Great question. So $300 million, what does that even mean? It's about a 13% cut, from my understanding, for the system, and the system is saying that's probably the biggest that they know of in their history. And then I looked around the country, 30 years worth of data, to see, well, what other states have had such a big cut, not just in $300 million size cuts, but in the share of their budget. It could be a bigger than 13% cut. And there were only a handful of states over time that have done that. And typically, they came during recessions. And so in New England states, they got particularly hit hard during the 1990s recession. And you saw some huge cuts there. And New England states aren't that favorable to public education in the first place. So that was not a big surprise. And you saw in Texas in the late, 1980s, there's an oil glut. Texas sort of went into the state recession, and they saw a really big cut. And these are external sort of shocks to the system that were not really policy decisions, not really manufactured, at least not in the ways that it seems like this current cut is manufactured from policy choices. Most states, actually almost all of them, are actually increasing their budgets by about 5%. Louisiana right now, Governor Jindal down there, his administration is proposing similar cuts, $300 million over biennium, and they're threatening to close down campuses and have layoffs and everything. So these are really the Wisconsin and Louisiana experiences now are going in the exact opposite direction of what most states are going. And we're out of the recession, so it really is it's hard to pinpoint exactly the source of this problem.
Nick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Nicholas Hillman. He's Assistant Professor of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at the UW-Madison.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
The State Department of Natural Resources is kicking off a plan that will bring a herd of new elk to Wisconsin and bolster the population of a species that was once native to the state.
Elk were first successfully reintroduced to Wisconsin in the 90s, but their numbers have failed to grow at the rate that wildlife biologists and elk advocates would have liked to see. Now up to 150 new elk will be brought to Wisconsin from Kentucky to boost the state's elk population, nearly doubling it, actually. But some concerns still linger over the possibility of the elk spreading disease like CWD into areas of the state that have more or less been spared of it so far.
Joining us now to talk about Wisconsin's elk comeback plan and how the animals will be managed is Kevin Wallenfang. He's a big game ecologist at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Kevin, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, my pleasure.
So what is the plan for rebuilding the elk herd in Wisconsin?
Well, you know, back in the 1990s, there was 25 elk donated to the state of Wisconsin from the state of Michigan, and those animals were actually put out there as an experiment. It was not an official elk reintroduction effort. It was really done by some local folks with department backing and the UW-Stevens Point to put them out there and just see what kind of success rates we could get from that. So Wisconsin has never really had an official elk reintroduction program. And although that population has grown to about 160 animals or so, this is really the first effort to try to really bring animals in and bolster that population and help it flourish as it was always intended. So we are in the process of working with the state of Kentucky right now to bring animals in. Some of those will eventually go to the Clam Lake area where our current population is, and some of them will go to the Black River Falls area in Jackson County, where those folks, again, comes down to grassroots interest, and they've been hoping for an elk population there for over 15 years. So that is all coming together as we speak.
How soon could we see these Kentucky elk here in Wisconsin?
They're being trapped right now, and they will spend time in Kentucky once the trapping actually ceases. They will go through a quarantine period and whatnot down there, a variety of disease testing. And if everything goes according to plan, we could see those elk up here in Wisconsin by the middle of March to early April. But again, after they arrive here, they will be held again in a quarantine pen, tested again for a variety of diseases before they're actually let go out on the landscape.
Now, earlier we mentioned chronic wasting disease, CWD, and this has been a big concern in the state over the last several years. And I'm wondering if the quarantine you mentioned would effectively ensure that these elk don't have any kind of CWD.
Well, we're not just concerned about chronic wasting disease. There's a variety of diseases that we are testing for. And our goal from the very beginning has been to bring in the healthiest animals that we possibly could. So in addition to chronic wasting disease, you know, there are rules that we are following for tuberculosis, brucellosis, and then voluntarily testing for a variety of other diseases that they could be carrying. So chronic wasting disease is one of those diseases that there is no reliable live test for those animals. So what you need to do is go to a location where you reduce risk. And Kentucky is a state that has been testing for chronic wasting disease since 2002. So they've got a long history of a very vigorous testing program for chronic wasting disease as well as some of the other diseases I've mentioned. And, you know, they have to clear certain hurdles. They have to be approved by the USDA to export elk. And both states, their Department of Agriculture needs to approve what's going on here. So they are a state that carries this status of low risk. And so we are going with as low risk as we possibly can. And we are following to the letter everything that the Department of Agriculture is asking us to do and then some.
So these are USDA approved elk, and you've got a quarantine going on, which should cut down on any risk of disease. But is it theoretically possible that a Kentucky elk could pick up the disease, pass quarantine, and come to Wisconsin?
Theoretically, it is possible. But again, it's all about reducing risk, and we continue to do that every step of the way.
Well, let's talk about the animal itself. What do we need to know about elk?
Well, the reason people want elk in Wisconsin, first of all, and there's a great following behind us here. There's Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation has, I think, close to 10,000 members in the state. Wisconsin is known for folks that love to go out west and not only hunt elk, but to view elk and take photographs and everything else that goes with it. The reason for that is elk are one of those big critters that, you know, they make a lot of noise. They're spectacular to see if you've ever been out west, especially during the September bugling season when these animals are more visible and they're bugling and they're performing, if you want to call it that, in their effort to try to find a mate. They're a spectacular animal to have out in the wilderness. And, you know, they are historically a part of the Wisconsin landscape. And as we know in Wisconsin, we are a state of great conservationists that want nothing more than to have a full spectrum of native habitat out there, or a native species out there. And, you know, we've brought back other animals like the whooping cranes and swans and peregrine falcons. And this is kind of going along with that same conservation-minded effort that Wisconsin is so well known for. Elk are a big, beautiful animal, and there's lots of folks out there that just love to see them.
Now, you mentioned bugling, which now that I've heard an elk bugle doesn't even begin to describe it. There's kind of nothing like it. Let's listen to an elk bugle. I would not have known that was from an elk. An elk makes that noise, huh?
It's spectacular, and I can tell you that if you've ever been close to one when it's doing that, you know, 20 or 30 yards away from one, it rattles the brush that you're concealing yourself in. It's really a spectacular thing, and right now, you know, you can go up into the Clam Lake area in the fall, and you can hear that happening, and, you know, it brings tourism to the area. You look any place in the eastern United States where there are elk, and there are people coming there. They're spending money. They're staying in hotels and buying food at the restaurants and whatnot. It's going to be very good for Wisconsin's economy. Even the small herd that we have in Clam Lake right now, Clam Lake is a very small town. You can pretty much throw a rock across it. And yet, to the area of Clam Lake and Cable and whatnot, they estimate about $200,000 of elk-related money coming into that community every year. So, you know, when you put a herd like that so close to Minneapolis, you know, 2 hours from Minneapolis, 2 hours from Madison, up in the Jackson County area, make it easily accessible for people to get to, they are excited up there. The Black River Chamber of Commerce and others are fully behind this and can't wait for it to happen.
So they're incredible animals, and they obviously have incredible vocalizations. You mentioned tourism. Is hunting elk also part of the ultimate goal here?
I wouldn't say that it's part of the ultimate goal, but it is a likelihood in the future. I mean, sooner or later, we will have an elk hunting season in Wisconsin. But I can tell you, looking back 20 years, that the folks that really pushed to have an elk season or to have an elk reintroduction in Wisconsin, I've heard many of them say many times, our goal was never to have an elk hunting season in Wisconsin. If that happened, great, it was an extra benefit. But the goal was just to put that animal back out there on the landscape.
And we're also approaching a new budget cycle here in Wisconsin, meaning that any project that isn't viewed as essential right now for the state is going to be looked at really closely. How is this particular effort to bring back, to repopulate the elk, how is it being paid for?
It is being paid for through private dollars. We made a commitment from the very start that this project would only happen if there was private funding behind it. So there are a variety of partners out there from national organizations like the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation down to local conservation groups. The Ho-Chunk Nation is behind it. The Chippewa tribes in far northern Wisconsin have actually helped fund elk management programs and reintroduction from the very beginning through tribal gaming money. And there's lots of other partners out there. I mean, way back when Safari Club International was involved, you know, the National Forest is involved, county forests are involved. So it's a variety of both cash and in-kind services that folks are donating to this. And we think that we can pull this off with that kind of money. And there's continuous fundraising going on among those groups.
Now, you mentioned the Ho-Chunk and the Chippewa. Why are they advocates of bringing the elk back?
Well, elk are a big part of their culture historically. I mean, you know, the Ho-Chunk Nation and I believe also the Chippewa tribes have elk clans as part of their culture. So it's always been part of their culture, and they are excited to be bringing that back. The Ho-Chunk, especially where this first group of elk are going, they are just super thrilled, and they've actually put money behind it to help make it happen. So they feel the connection to the outdoors, to wildlife, and for them, this is kind of completing a circle that one of their major cultures within their tribe is being returned to them. They're thrilled to death.
And just briefly, any long-term goals for scientific value and herd numbers for these elk?
Well, as far as numbers go, the long-term goals are to have a total population of about 1,400 in the Clam Lake area and about 390, 400 elk in the Jackson County area. So, you know, those are a ways off. We are hoping that bringing these new animals in is going to kind of give a flush to that population, and herd growth will take place a bit quicker than it has up in northern Wisconsin in the Clam Lake area. We have seen herd growth throughout the entire time, but it has been slow at some point. So we're trying to help that along.
We'll leave that there. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
We've been speaking with Kevin Wallenfang, big game ecologist at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, talking about the agency's plan to bolster the state's elk population.
I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. In just a moment, we'll get some Food Friday advice for Super Bowl Sunday.
First, before Governor Scott Walker proposed cutting the UW system by $300 million over 2 years, university leaders were already trying to find ways to save money through overhauling business practices. President Ray Cross laid out a number of proposals recently, including an analysis of back office operations. As part of a series on UW reforms, Maureen McCollum has more on what this could mean for campuses.
Back office staff workers perform duties that essentially keep the UW system a well-oiled machine. They're the people who work in payroll and the IT department. They're the maintenance crew who empty the trash in the classrooms and vacuum the hallways, like this custodian at UW La Crosse. These non-instructional campus employees often feel nervous when discussions about budget cuts and creating efficiencies come up. Denise Aaron is the chair of UW-Whitewater's University Staff Council and the Recreational Sports Office Manager. She says morale is low right now, with some employees looking to retire and others fearing they're replaceable.
Like, we'll never be those people that are prized employees because we only provide support. We're not the people on stage that are visible every day. We're the people in the background.
Aaron says it's good that the UW system wants to take a hard look at business practices and says there's always room for improvement. But she says staff feel like they need to protect themselves and their jobs right now. Regardless, Aaron says any business decision should have a limited impact on the students.
That's kind of really the goal overall. We're here to help them, and we're here to help them learn and succeed in the world, and we need to do that as painlessly as possible.
The back office analysis is underway throughout the UW system. President Ray Cross says he's trying to show the public and legislators that it's responsible and can be held accountable.
Should we do what we can to reduce costs and to drive our savings into the classroom for the benefit of students and their families and the public? Yes. It's hard to argue with these outcomes.
Cross talks about streamlining business operations, but says it's too early to say if this will result in layoffs. He says it could mean moving people into other positions or even approaching purchasing differently. Cross used to head up UW Colleges and UW Extension, which is often looked to as the poster child of efficiencies within the system. For its 13 campuses and online education program, it has one centralized financial aid office, one registrar's office, and is currently creating one human resources department. Vice Chancellor for Administrative and Financial Services, Steve Wildeck, says it's yet to be seen if the colleges and extension model can be duplicated on a system-wide level and is easier said than done. Plus, he says UW system administration is already quite lean.
I certainly support the president's intent, and that is to review major functions to make sure that we're not duplicating efforts across the system and across our institutions that perhaps don't need to be done on the ground many times over locally when it can be done once in a consolidated unit.
The UW system is working with Chicago-based Huron Consulting Group on the effort to find efficiencies and savings. Through this process, UW System predicts it will spend up to $322,000 in consulting fees to take a hard look at system administration. Huron is also working with several other UW campuses. President Ray Cross says he hopes to present recommendations on business practices in 4 to 6 months. Maureen McCollum, Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse.
The Super Bowl, the high holiday of football. It's coming up this Sunday. Not everyone's into the game or the teams this year, but most people can agree on one thing, the food.
Well, whether or not you're in it for the food, our guest for this Food Friday has some great recipes to share and ideas that help you do more than just slave away in the kitchen. Amy Hanton joins us now. She's a blogger, a cookbook author, and the host of the lifestyle and cooking show Living with Amy on Fox 11 in Green Bay. Amy, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
So, Amy, what's your favorite thing about the food on Super Bowl Sunday?
A lot of it, and forget the diet. I know, you know, it's the new year, and we're trying to stick to healthy, healthy eating, but not on Super Bowl Sunday. And for me, I think a lot of people in Wisconsin, especially those of us Packers fans, are a little bit bummed that the Packers aren't in the game. And a lot of people have said, you know what, I'm not even going to watch it. But you are. You're totally going to watch it come Sunday. You know, you're going to want to see, it's the biggest football game of the year. So, you know, if you're a football fan at all, you're going to be watching. You're going to be watching the commercials. It's supposed to be a great halftime show. And so why not make an occasion of it? And my passion and mission these days is to try and get people eating around the table or, in this case, get families and friends, you know, hanging out around the TV and creating memories. It's more than just cooking. It's about some, you know, great times. And so I've put together some really easy, fun recipes that will keep you out of the kitchen. And, you know, so you won't miss a play or that commercial that everybody's talking about on Monday morning. You don't want to be that person, you guys, that missed the commercial that was the one, because you were slaving away in the kitchen.
So we'll get to a couple recipes in a bit, but what are some of the key things to keep in mind as we're trying to create that event around the game with our food? What do we need to keep in mind to plan that menu?
A lot of dips and munchies. You know, I think that is for sure huge. I, you know, a big fan, what's back and really on trend are cheese balls, believe it or not. It's so funny because here in Wisconsin, we've been in love with cheese and anything cheese balls forever. And we're not talking about those holiday cheese balls that are pre-made that you can get in the grocery store that if you look at the ingredients, they just, they don't taste like much. We're talking about putting together that you can do today or tomorrow a really great homemade cheese ball with cream cheese. I do cream cheese and bacon and cheddar cheese, and one of mine has a splash of beer in it, and that you can make them ahead. I even form the, use your hands, and it's real easy to do, to form it into a football shape and then cover it with nuts and bacon or bacon, and you can even use like roasted red pepper or slices of cheese to make the laces to make it look like a football. And that's a really fun make ahead, and it does double duty, not only as a great snack and dip, but it also looks really cute on your game day buffet. So lots of great dips, and we can talk about a bunch of those for sure. That's a must. Big, messy sandwiches, also a must. You know, come on, it's a Super Bowl. You got to have something really big and messy, and I've got some really fun recipes we can talk about as far as that goes. Chili bars or like some sort of a soup bar is great. It's cold out. It's winter. So you don't want to do like all cold hors d'oeuvres this time of year or cold munchies. So I also have some perfect slow cooker recipes that it's kind of my secret weapon when it comes to entertaining.
Right. So if you're hosting a party, the worst is when you don't actually go to your own party, where you just sort of, you're the short order cook, you're at the grill or you're stationed in the kitchen.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing that you like to cook a lot of stuff ahead of time and getting it out there using the slow cooker, pre-prepared things. Is it easy to do to get everything prepared ahead of time?
Well, first of all, Veronica, I've been that person where I have been in the kitchen the whole time.
Me too.
And then at the end of the party, I'm like, you know, honey, to my husband, I'm never doing this again because it was a lot of work and it wasn't any fun. So I tried to figure out a way, how can I entertain and have fun at my own party, and especially during the Super Bowl? I mean, you know, it's a long winter. You got to make an occasion of it. So make-aheads are the key. So, like, today and tomorrow is a great time to, you know, throw some quick, easy dips together. I do a chili and cheese dip that is just, it couldn't be any easier. It's just a few packages of cream cheese that you press in the bottom of a casserole dish, a can or two of no-bean chili that goes on top of it, shredded cheddar cheese. So you can throw that together right now, park it in your fridge, cover it, and then right before kickoff, or even a little bit before when those good commercials start, throw it in the oven, but the work is done. You're just throwing it in the oven to warm it up, serve it with chips or Fritos. That's a dip that my grandmother used to make for us. I'm still making it to this day, and anybody can make that. So, yeah, lots of make-aheads. And like I said, your slow cooker really is your best friend, because I don't want to be getting up helping everybody when they're hungry. I want to put it all out on my kitchen island or my kitchen table, the spread, before the game starts, and say, have at it, everybody. Go for it. My kids love nachos. A nacho bar is a really great way to go. And, you know, kids are really into the Super Bowl, too. It's not just an adult thing. So I do what I call the ultimate nachos. And that's something, again, you can do today or tomorrow. Park it in your fridge and just warm it up in the slow cooker. Really, really easy to do. And then put out a big basket of chips and a bunch of your favorite nacho fixings, like shredded lettuce, diced tomatoes, sliced black olives, scallions, pickled jalapenos, and sour cream. But the key is this wonderful cheesy nacho sauce that starts with just browning up some ground beef, and then I add a packet of taco seasoning mix, about a cup and a half of water, let that cook together. Then a whole big box, 32 ounces of Velveeta that I've cubed up, goes in there, so it becomes this cheesy, beefy, melty concoction. A little bit of milk or heavy cream, and one can of diced tomatoes with green chili. So you get that all going either after you've browned the beef and the taco seasoning, then you can throw it all in your slow cooker and let that melt down on game day. Or you can do it ahead in a saucepan and then transfer the whole thing to your slow cooker, but then just put a ladle out with this beefy cheese mixture and then all those nacho fixings, and everybody, you know, can help themselves and ladle that cheese mixture on top of the chips and then put on their toppings. Am I making you hungry? Because I'm getting hungry thinking about it right now.
Well, you're not kidding about skipping the diet here. Let's get to one of the recipes that you sent us. So we've got it up at the Central Time Facebook page, the Italian beef sandwich.
Yeah, I talked about big messy sandwiches.
Yeah,
I
mean, why do you want messy sandwiches when people are in your living room? Come
well,
on.
Well, because that's the whole fun of it. You know, just get plenty of napkins, get extra big paper plates, maybe line your carpet with, you know, big, thick, heavy-duty plastic. I'm kidding. but, you know, just say, hey, you know, people be careful, there's extra napkins. And you know what? I always say a little mess in the kitchen, that's what vacuums and dogs are for. But, you know, big, messy sandwiches, it's the Super Bowl. It's a guy thing. And I love a big, messy sandwich, too. So hot Italian beef sandwiches, that's one of my family's favorites. We make it all year round, not just at Super Bowl, but this is one that they also request. And it's so easy breezy because, again, the slow cooker does the work. So Sunday morning, you're just going to throw yourself a nice, big, 5-pound, I prefer a beef chuck roast or a rump roast, you could do whatever's on sale, but I really like the chuck roast. Get a big one because this is going to shrink down and really kind of cooks down. So sometimes if you can't find a big 5-pound one, I'll get a couple, like 2.5 to 3-pound roasts and stick them in there. And then you boil some water and throw in there salt, pepper, oregano, dried basil, onion salt, dried parsley, garlic powder, a bay leaf. And the secret ingredient is one packet of the dried Italian seasoning mix, and you just boil that for a few minutes. You dump that over your roast, turn your slow cooker on low, and let it cook low and slow. So you'd want to start that Sunday morning, you know, about 8, 9 in the morning, let it cook low and slow all day, and then by kickoff, it's going to just fall apart on you. Pick up some nice crusty rolls from the bakery, and then you're going to have some great shredded beef. Just get in with your forks, and it's just going to fall apart. And then take that meat. Everybody can, again, help themselves. It's all shredded up in the slow cooker, so just take them. You know, they can, you know, pile on the meat on the crusty rolls. And then if, you know, in Chicago, a good hot beef, Italian beef sandwich, they say, do you like it wet? So basically you can spoon some of that au jus in there over the sandwich, and it's delicious. Again, you guys are killing me. I haven't eaten. I'm getting hungry. It's almost dinner time.
I know.
know. We're getting all ready for Super Bowl now. All these recipes. Well, that one, if that's making you hungry, it's already up on the Central Time Facebook page. You can start your menu planning right there as we talk with Amy Hanton, blogger, cookbook author, and the host of the lifestyle cooking show Living with Amy on Fox 11 in Green Bay.
She's helping us plan our Super Bowl menus. We want to hear from you. What is your must-have menu item on Super Sunday? Got any tricks for planning ahead so you get to watch the game instead of spending the whole time in the kitchen? Or a combination of beer and cheese heretofore unknown to humankind? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Right now, we're getting warmed up for Super Bowl Sunday, and that what we're doing is the important stuff. We're planning the menu.
And we want to hear from you. What is your must-have menu item on game day? Or your favorite go-to dish? Maybe some tips on getting it ready ahead of time instead of having to cook during the game. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Amy Hanton is with us. She's a blogger, a cookbook author, and she's host of the lifestyle cooking show Living with Amy on Fox 11 in Green Bay. And we're going to go to a first caller now. Chris is with us in Grant County. Hi, Chris.
Hey, good afternoon. I enjoy the show and just wanted to call. I really like Amy's recommendation for Italian
great.
Beef. Something that we do that I just thought, you know, would be great to share is that we'll do the exact same thing with the chuck roast, but it's actually we just take a can of green salsa, dump it on top, sprinkle a packet of ranch, powdered ranch dressing on top, let that cook all day, pull it apart, and you can go for the Italian beef with, or you can go for tacos, but it's such a simple recipe, one of our go-tos, and, you know, we'll throw in a frozen chuck roast or a thawed one, it doesn't matter, cook it all day, and just great munching food, so...
Sounds
just thought
yummy.
I'd share that.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Chris. Appreciate that. So this is a trick that a lot of people like, throwing the jar of salsa on whatever it is in the crock pot, maybe some ranch seasoning, and it goes a long way, right? Have you tried that one, Amy?
Chris, I love Chris's recipe. Thank you. That's the way I roll, and I love that. That would be great shredded in burritos, so you could put out flour tortillas and then, again, kind of create that whole, like I was talking about with the nacho bar, so your favorite Mexican fixings. That roast would be great over nachos because basically you'd have pulled beef nachos. One of the things with slow cooking, Veronica, and is that the liquid that it's braising in, and all of a sudden I've become a slow cooker expert. People call me from around the country, and who knew? Because slow cooking is really making a comeback because we're all so busy. I mean, it's just the way we roll. But the liquid that you're cooking in has to be really flavorful, that braising liquid that's going to break down that meat, whatever it is, pork or beef or even chicken, low and slow, because a lot of times you're not taking the time to brown the beef or the chicken. You're just throwing it in there in the morning. So you can't just do water. You also want to make sure you've got plenty of it. You know, beer is a great thing to add, a little splash of beer, and the alcohol will cook off most of it. It'll just add some great flavor. Salsa, I would also put in there with Chris's recipe a little bit of chicken stock, which is a very neutral flavor, but it will create a lot of nice juices and keep whatever you're cooking really nice and juicy. So keep that in mind, whatever you're slow cooking. Don't just throw water in there. Think about, putting some different, really flavorful braising liquids in there to let it cook low and slow and have a lot of flavor when the dish is all done. And also season. Yes, I love using a packet or two of ranch dressing or dried Italian dressing meat seasoning because that's a big piece of meat that you're doing in there, or several chicken breasts or a big pork roast, and it really needs to be seasoned. And so season it well or it's not going to taste good at the end.
My secret for chicken or pork is the green salsa and canned pineapple. That really adds a lot of great flavor to it. I want to get into some of your other ideas, Amy, before we're done. Saw a picture on your blog, a mini football stadium made of chips and dips. How do we recreate that?
This is a fun one. You know, this is something that my food stylist and I, she's great. She's really creative. And, I wanted to make it easy so that anyone could do it. And this is really fun. I've made this on a few TV stations the last 10 days. I've been on the road cooking up Super Bowl recipes in Chicago, Detroit, Minneapolis, Milwaukee, all over the place. They really like our Wisconsin recipes, let me tell you. So this is super fun. And it's really, really easy. You get a big, a really big platter, but you might not have a platter that big. And if you don't, you don't have to go out and buy one. So you, I'm sure you have a baking sheet, like an 11 by 13, some sort of a baking sheet or a cookie sheet. And what I've done, there's a cup, you know, you can get creative with this. This is more of a method, but I do one where I spread the entire baking sheet with guacamole, or you can spread the middle of it with guacamole and then the two end zones with a couple of different things. Like you could do hummus. In the one I've got pictured right now that we just did in Chicago, I've got my homemade pico de gallo in one of the end zones, and then just a store-bought, you know, jar of nacho cheese sauce in the other end zone. And then I just surround it with a bunch of chips so that it really looks like a football field. So I've got Doritos and pretzels and Cheetos, all those really naughty things that you really are only allowed to have permission to have them on Super Bowl. And then for the players, I took little beef sticks and just cut them into little pieces, you know, really easy to do. And then for the different helmets, I used two different types of cheese. You could do M&M's, like that. We've got the Patriots and the Seahawks, so you could do red M&M's for the Patriots, and then green M&M's for the Seahawks. Really have fun with it. And then I lined, used sour cream to make the lines on the field, and then the, you know, 50-yard line, used, just put that in a piping bag or cut the corner of a small Ziploc bag. I am no, you know, pastry chef. It's got to be really keeping it easy, keeping it real. So this is something, if I can do it, you can do it. And then really easy, I just use toothpicks and, again, use beef sticks as the goalposts, and took a big hunk of cheese to stick those in to hold it up. If you want to get a visual for this, because I'm sure you're saying, what in the world is she talking about?
It kind of
about?
Has to be seen to
go
be believed.
Go to my website. You'll see a couple different pictures. I also throw Rice Krispie treats in there. You can surround it. If you want to make it look like a dome stadium, you can use Twinkies. And there's a video, too. But my thing is have fun with it. And once again, it's a real wow factor. And the kids can help with this. So it serves double duty as, you know, it's not only food that you can eat and munch on, but it really is cute, a cute centerpiece. Take a picture quick, though, because in minutes, it's not going to look so cute.
And Amy, real quick, we're almost out of time here. You've got a recipe that you gave us for sausage and cheese chowder. What do you love about that?
Okay, this is my go-to. This is the one thing you're going to make from my blog, my cookbook, my recipes, either for game day or just this winter. You need to make this. This is a recipe. The New York Times is looking for the ultimate football food. And so I submitted this recipe, and immediately they said, yeah, this is it. This is absolutely it. So it's really kind of gone viral, and it's the easiest thing. It's basically, you get out your slow cooker. The sausage and cheese chowder starts out really easy with a bag of frozen hash brown potatoes, the cube kind, or if you like O'Brien with the onions and peppers, use that. Dump it in there with 1 pound of smoked sausage like kielbasa.
Hey, Amy, the clock is ticking on this game. We're going to have to refer people to the Central Time Facebook page to get the rest of the details. Yeah.
A nice tease there, though, for people who want to hear the rest. Go to the Facebook page. That was Amy Hansen, blogger, cookbook author, and host of the Lifestyle Cooking Show, Living with Amy on Fox 11 in Green Bay.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, forget the game and the food. A lot of people are going to watch the ads on Sunday. We'll hear about the biggest hits and misses.
That's coming up Monday here on Central Time, along with a look at the role played by animal rescue organizations. Stay with us. That's Monday on the show.
Weekday mornings from 6 to 9, it's the Joy Cardine Show. Monday after 6, a wildlife biologist checks in on efforts to save the migratory monarch butterfly population. There's been some good news, but there's a long road ahead. That's Monday after 6 on the Joy Cardine Show. Even though not all of the Central Time producers know who Paul McCartney is, hashtag who's Paul McCartney, we're going to point out that today is a special day for Beatles fans.
That's right. On this day in 1969, the Beatles performed together for the last time on the rooftop of the Apple Studios. And although you just can't win, even if you're giving a free concert, because the police interrupted after the neighbors complained about the noise. Who does that? Who complains about a free rooftop concert by the Beatles?
Yeah, so many rumors and talks that they might get back together again, do a concert over the years. Obviously, it never happened, sadly. So, yeah, would have loved to have that one just go the full length as planned. But their neighbors in New York, some of them weren't keen on it.
Well, we're going to go out to the news with a little music from that day, from that concert. Here's a version of Don't Let Me Down, the last concert that the Beatles did.
Nobody ever loved me like she does. Ooh, she does. Yes, yeah, she does. me like she does.